Last week, for those of you who were here, I shared the dais with my friend Shivani, who is one of my earliest Ananda sisters from the early 70s. As it happens, Shivani never left. She's still here in the front row now instead of on the dais with me. And we've spent this whole week, she was here with Santoshi to talk to all of you, which many of you stayed for after service last week, to talk about a movie that she's producing. She's in charge of producing. It's called Cities of Light, and it's about the Ananda communities. And the intention of that movie is to share in the way only movies can, the potential of cooperative spiritual communities. The script has needed a certain amount of review because shooting is starting soon, and for the last year, Shivani has acted as if I was going to help her. But it wasn't until she was actually in my living room and I thought we were having a play date. And I realized her idea of a good time was that we were going to sit at our table and go over the script line by line, which we've essentially been doing for the last solid week, which has been really totally fun and has had several effects on me, which is what I wanted to share. One is being with Shivani again, which is really almost the first time for 25 years or more, because we've been on different continents all this time. It's putting me sort of, I don't quite know exactly where I am. I don't know whether I'm 25 or 65. I don't know whether I'm living at Ananda Village or living here. I look around the house and, you know, we make cappuccino on this fancy machine, which was nothing about our early years, believe me. So I have clues, you know, and I can see that Shivani's not as young as she used to be. And so I'm deducing that it looks the same when she looks my direction. And then just to make it all the more fun, I do these webinars every other Friday, which I do through Ananda Online Community. And just a year ago, when I set 12 months of webinars, the ones for this month are about the early years at Ananda Village. So here I am talking about, again, being 22, 24, 26, 28, and just all that experience of finding this path for the first time. After the program was over, Shivani remarked that all my stories were about Swami Kriyananda, which was actually very interesting to me because all my stories are about Swami Kriyananda. I never actually lived at Ananda Village per se. I lived where Swami Kriyananda was. And my actual experience of Ananda for all the years that I lived there was really quite different than many other people's, because I worked for him much of the time, and had a constant, almost daily association with him, which entirely defined absolutely everything that I did for a number of years. Every day at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Seva and I, and sometimes Prakash, sometimes Kalyani, various others, would be at Swamiji's, have to be at Swami's house. The way Ananda Village is set up, there's this hill, and the workplaces are on one side, and Swami Kriyananda's house, Crystal Hermitage, for those of you who've seen it, is on the other. In the years that I'm talking about, there was no electricity in any of the other areas on the other side of the hill. No telephone line, no electricity. Email and computers hadn't even been invented. So the mail, remember the mail? The mail was delivered in these big sacks, paper, and then we would receive it on one side of the hill, and then at 4 o'clock we'd carry it over. And the only phone lines were on the other side of the hill, so calls would come in for Swamiji, and then those messages would be carried across. I mean, in fact, we did a skit once, and we put two chairs back to back, and the whole of Ananda, for those of us who lived on the other side of the hill, was stepping on the chair, stepping over the hill, stepping on the chair, stepping down. It was just crossing this hill back and forth. But having to be at his house every day at 4 o'clock, you can imagine you don't make a lot of plans. You know, you finish your day job, which I had. You finish your day job, you cross the hill. Once we arrived at his house, we never knew when we would leave. Sometimes we'd leave in 15 minutes if he was working. Sometimes I'd stay and cook dinner. Sometimes he'd invite us for dinner. Sometimes we'd go back to work afterwards. You know, sometimes we'd leave at 10, 12 at night. And I did that for years. And this is not a complaint by any means. It was my priority, period. To learn from Swami, to be in his company, to get serious about the path, and the best way I could see it was to have his darshan, basically, plus his teaching. So everything was really settled. Even when I go to Ananda Village now and Swami Kriyananda's not there, I'm a little confused because I don't know how to live up there without that confining definition. I never made consistent plans for myself. I always just waited. And he responded. Now everything is different. I mean, I've been living in Palo Alto for 25 years. But what's interesting to me, and this is what I'm wanting to share, and I listen to these readings, and there's so many aspects of the spiritual path. Well, there's I've not finished about four thoughts here. Let me try to finish one. Okay? In the Bhagavad Gita, there's a verse, and that verse is, what is day to the worldly man is night to the yogi. And what is night to the worldly man is day for the yogi. Now, we're not talking worldly, we're not trying to cast aspersions on people necessarily, but worldly in this sense means people who look out through their senses and define reality by what they see out through their senses. Now, the definition of a yogi is someone who meditates, and the very definition of meditation is that we cut off our outward-looking senses, don't we? When my father, who tried to be supportive, but frankly hadn't the foggiest idea what I was really doing, came to Ananda Village once to visit, and he saw that meditation was scheduled. He asked if he could go in and watch. I said, not a lot happens. You know, like nothing. Like people are just sitting there, apparently doing nothing. Because all that we would normally do, after a little bit of chanting maybe and so on, is all that we do normally is we use our body as a vehicle to move outward from it. But meditation is we put earplugs on, we close our eyes, we sit perfectly still. If we bring any fragrance in, we bring in incense or something. We try not to be disturbed by touch or anything like that. Absolutely the opposite of the way life seems to be. And so Krishna, who represents inner intuition, the guru, the presence of God, in the conversation with Krishna, who represents us, the devotee, with Arjuna, us, the devotee, which is the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna's trying to figure this out. Because the essence of that conversation is, I'm supposed to fight this war, I'm supposed to kill people, I'm supposed to do all these things. Doesn't that seem like a really bad idea? And Krishna says, essentially, in so many, many, many wonderful words, he says, well, things are not what they seem. That you, from your perspective, see it one way, I, from my perspective, meaning the divine perspective, see it entirely different. And it's epitomized by that one phrase. It's really complete opposites. I got a letter recently from a young couple, and part of their excitement in their new relationship is their physical connection, their sexual excitement. And there was this effort to persuade me that this is such a great thing that I should just cheer it on. And at the same time, being a sincere devotee, he's a little bewildered because nothing in the scripture supports him at this point. And so much in yoga practice encourages us to go in a completely other way. You know, in the masters, Yogananda, you know, they can say really, really disparaging things about sexuality. They can say really, really unpleasant things about it from the point of view of the excited young couple. And I wrote to him, this is a very hard question to answer because I don't think there's any area of life in which the disparity between what the masters declare with such force and what people grasp from their own experience is so different. And yet, at the same time, the scriptures tell us you have to go by your own experience. A master calls this the science of religion. Self-realization is what we ourselves are able to experience, and the basis of our spiritual life is not a priest telling you this or a scripture telling you that or a dogma telling you this. None of those things. It's we turn our attention to our own inner reality and we experience what's true. Now, the fine line on the spiritual path is to be able to believe what we have no experience of, live by what we know, but not limit reality to what we already know. I was actually sitting here while I was getting ready to stand up, being intensely embarrassed about a lot of stupid things I did over a lot of decades that I thought were wise at the time, because they were solidly my experience. And not being blessed with a timid nature, if I believe it, I say it, right? And then only later do I realize, wow, I didn't really have the whole picture there, did I? Now, one of the ways that we learn is to not be afraid, to just stand up by our own experience. And even though what this young man wrote to me I couldn't entirely endorse, I also had to say to him, frankly, if that's your experience, then you simply need to be honest in it. But the danger is that we'd say, the top of the mountain doesn't look so, it looks awfully high to me, so I'm just going to say I'm standing on it right now. Doesn't that look good? You know? And we are so caught up in so many points of view that really are not what the masters think, that it's a very razor's edge to be constantly open to new realities and still be completely sincere in where we stand. The danger on the spiritual path is that we don't have the courage to be, as I wrote to this man, I said, your present state of consciousness is not the one you're going to have ultimately. The masters say, ultimately, we transcend sexuality, not because it's bad, this is what you have to understand, but because it's physical. You see, it's of the physical body. And it's one of those, you know, really humdingers of a thing that just holds us to the physical body. But it's not in itself really bad or good. It's simply physical. And the entire definition of ego is the infinite spirit identified with the physical body. And the more we do things that just affirm that identity over and over and over again, the more deeply and profoundly we believe that's who we are. And ultimately, that's a problem. We might not think it's a problem now. After all, I remember Ananta, who is my contemporary, looking out over this crowd of people who were in their 20s. He said, enjoy those bodies while they're still beautiful and working so well, he said. You know, because it's just not always going to be true. We set ourselves up, we commit ourselves, I've finally found the way, and may not even realize that it's based on the fact that my physical body works in a certain way now. And I'm identified with it and I'm living in it now, and so this must be the truth. But heavens, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, I was amazed. I mean, now I'm in my 60s. Around your 50s is when things begin to collapse in a more noticeable manner. I don't mean that you become crippled, because with energization in Kriya we stay strong, but you know, I used to be a lot younger and a lot more beautiful in the conventional way. And I look in the mirror and I sort of see it beginning to disintegrate. I changed my hairdresser every haircut for 5 years because I thought it was their fault. And then at some point, some hairdresser sort of going like this said, honey, everything gets old. And then I thought, ah, that's really what's happening. But here's what astonished me about it. That I noticed and that I cared. I thought to myself, how many physical bodies have I had? And if they didn't die young, they died old each time. And therefore this happened to me over and over and over again. How could I have bought into this one more time? You know? But there's just this strange reality that the masters declare, and we get to know their truth. And we feel their joy, either by the physical proximity, which some of us have had the opportunity to be with Swami Kriyananda or other great souls, or we feel it inside. Even though I am not always with you, Jesus said, he is sometimes. He's with us enough for us to realize we have a little experience or a big experience or a lot of experience. And it says, oh! What's day to the worldly man is really night to the yogi, but what the worldly man can't see is bliss for me. When I first started at Ananda in those early years in my 20s, I was so driven to that life. I just walked away from everything I had, and I never, not once, and I say this with gratitude, not with pride, I never once looked back. I moved from an apartment at 4th and Geary in San Francisco to a tent in the woods. And I never noticed. And I lived in these tiny trailers, and, you know, gradually we had to, as Swamiji put it, you can't live too poor in America or people think there's something wrong with you. In India, where they understand renunciation, they respect you, as he put it, for being poor. In America, they think there must be something wrong with your group or else you could be a little better than that. So, as Swamiji also said, you have to pitch it right at a level, because if your environment is not refined enough, people will think your ideas are not refined either. So you have to create an environment that's just refined enough so that people in this country will feel comfortable and will then be open to what you're doing. It's also a new era in which matter and spirit are more combined. It's not such an issue. But nonetheless, I was so driven. I was then in my early 20s, but I'd been driven, well, since I was born, in this state of absolute confusion and near despair at looking out at the world and sensing that there was some fundamental thing wrong here that nobody around me seemed to know. But I said to Swamiji, I said, I haven't suffered at all in this lifetime. I was born to a nice family. They raised me very well. I wasn't wealthy, but I was certainly privileged by any normal standard. I was capable. I could function in this world. Anything I wanted was mine, and I never wanted any of it. Well, he said, the obvious previous lifetimes. We've been through this many times before. There's an inherent truth to the fact that even though we're born into these bodies and seem to experience life through it, there's another continuing reality that is neither not defined and in fact is confined completely by that physical identification. And the word they have in India, which is such a fabulous word, is Maya. Maya has many definitions, but one is Maya is the magician. Maya creates this illusion. We were in India once, and there was this magician who came and performed at the hotel where we were staying, and we knew it was tricks, but it just seemed like magic. There was no other way around it. How did the card that my friend had signed and had been and placed over here end up in this man's pocket? How could he put a cigarette into a silk scarf and wrap a lit cigarette around and then pull the scarf up and there's no hole in the scarf? You know, just things like that, illusions. And you looked at this man, he was a perfectly ordinary man. You knew he wasn't really a great yogi, you know, doing miracles. He was doing tricks, but they sure fooled me. Boy, did they fool me. And that's what Maya is. Maya fools us. She causes us, they make it a female. She causes us to, because the female is feeling, and feeling is required for this. She causes us to forget, even though we see it all around us, that I won't always be young, that my wife won't always be young and beautiful. You know, that everything around me changes, but I think it's not going to happen to me. That was in the Mahabharata. That was the greatest, what is the greatest delusion of all? That man sees everyone around him aging and dying and is convinced it won't happen to me. I mean, even I, watching my body age, was surprised and dismayed. And I'm not saying even I in the sense of being such a great example of this, but I never even cared when I was young. And then there I was. My, Maya is something really impressive. Now, what we're talking about today in our scripture, I mean, we're referring to the story that was also talked about last week, is the fact that in the midst of all of this, every so often it cracks. And some little piece of reality comes in, of greater reality comes in, and all of us grab it. You wouldn't be sitting here if some piece of it hadn't grabbed you. Somewhere, someplace, some part of your reality is not 100% satisfying to you. And somewhere in all of that, a little piece of that divine light came in. Maya was bested for a year, for a day, for an incarnation, and something came through and said, there is something else, and this is it. And the art of our lives is always to keep that. Last week, when the subject was the reverse of this, how do devotees fall, the story was about Judas. Judas was one of the apostles. He was one of Jesus' 12 chosen. And we all know that Jesus' life did not work out so well. Even standing there right next to Jesus with all that force, the world got him. And his confusion was, well, you know, these people have power, and if you just cultivated them a little more, and if you didn't just associate with these low kinds of people, but got the celebrities to endorse us and got the people with money on our side. And Jesus wouldn't have any of that. But Judas was determined, because what is day to the worldly man is night to the yogi. He just got a little confused. Now we have Mary as the opposite example, who had one perspective, and that perspective was her communion with her guru, was her communion with the presence of Jesus. To the absolute, she discarded everything else. And the story, as we heard it, just to remind you, in the midst of a dinner party, where all these men are in the room together, and where the men and women don't even associate, she just walks right into this room, kneels at Jesus' feet, bathes his feet with ointment, uses her hair to dry his feet. To say this was a shocking thing for her to do is putting it really, really mildly. The only one in the Bible that is talked about his dismay was Judas. But we can probably assume that a few other people were at least uncomfortable. You know, this is even those who might have, you know, loved Jesus. We think this is a bit extreme, don't we? Why are we behaving this way? Because we're always trying to sort of play all sides of it. We hear this divine call, but we think, well, yes, I know all the scriptures say that sex is really something ultimately to be transcended, but perhaps in this case not, you know? And my answer, again, as I said to him, was, look, your state of consciousness at the present time is nothing to be proud of, but nor is it anything to be ashamed of. You know, we don't want to go there. Religions spend all their time talking about sex, which is just crazy. They don't know what they're talking about. They don't understand what the issue really is. The issue is simply identification with the physical body. As Swami put it to me once, he said, I don't know why people become so obsessed about sexuality. He says it's a physical imperative, like being cold, like being hungry. We're bound by many, many physical imperatives. And the difficulty is that they lock us into identification with that body. There's nothing to be ashamed of in that. I mean, it's the lot of all of us. But nor is there anything to be proud of. You know? And that's where we have to watch that fine line. I was starting to say a while ago, when I first met Swami Kriyananda, he made so many, he's always been very forceful. And he doesn't hesitate to make strong statements of the perception of reality that he lives in. And sometimes he would say things that I just didn't know how to, I didn't know where to go with them at all. And at the same time, I had way too much respect for him and too much awareness of the gap between his state of consciousness and mine to be able to say he was wrong. But nothing in my experience told me that he was right. And so I would be caught in this reality. So I made up just a little mental game, which just worked for me. When he would say those things, I would take them and I would put them into nice boxes, and sometimes I would wrap them real pretty. I'd put ribbons on them, and I'd put them way up on the shelf, just way up. I'm sure you have a place in your house somewhere where you put stuff that you can't throw away because it was a gift from your great Aunt Matilda and she might come and visit you sometime, but wow, you don't want it anywhere where you have to look at it. So you put it way up there. So Swamiji would give us and give me spiritual concepts that were not useful as far as I could see. And in fact, if I became too obsessed with them, it could either confuse me, frighten me, distort my spiritual life, cause me to become hypocritical, to be insincere in my own beliefs, and this attempt, which we all fall into, to try to embrace something that's way beyond ourselves just so we'll look good, like this. So I would just box them all up and I'd put them in on the shelf. And then I would just live in the few things that worked for me. I know when I used to have a much bigger closet full of clothes, I had a big closet full of clothes, but I really just wore these, you know? So I'd take the others and I'd stick them over here. I was traveling once and I was so proud of myself because everything I wasn't using I had all in one suitcase. And then I thought, why did I bring it? You know, sometimes we just accumulate more than we can handle, but we use a certain part of it. So I had accumulated all these spiritual ideas that I couldn't throw away because they came from him, but I kept only a few of them right in the center of my closet. And found that by living 100%, even though some of it embarrasses me now, by living 100% sincerely, by what I knew, but always understanding that those that I respected were telling me a truth that I couldn't yet embrace, then little by little, you take the box down and you say, wow, this is fabulous. Why haven't I been using this? And of course, it hasn't changed any, but we've grown a little bigger. We've become a little less physically identified, a little less committed to the folly of youth or the chaos of a particular karmic period. We shouldn't be proud of what we are now and try to justify it and tell everyone how great it is and how we've really understood something that nobody else really understood. And I know Master says this, but I look at it like this. Just say, well, I know Master says this, but this is who I am now. I'm not proud of it, but there's no reason to be ashamed either. It's a very, very useful phrase. And I look back, I had this conversation with Swami Kriyananda once about something or another. Oh, I know, it was just something he'd wanted to do in the publications business during the time that I was in charge of it. And he would make this idea, and I would constantly oppose it. And he was so sensitive and respectful that instead of saying, you callow youth, you know nothing, and going forward, he allowed me, as he put it in this conversation, to thwart him. Yes, he said, Asha, I would have done it years ago, but Asha always thwarted me. Oh. I said, I believed I thwarted a lot of your good ideas. Yes, he said, yes. And then I said, well, whatever it was, sir, I apologize now. Apology accepted, he said like that. You know, just, we all had to live through it. It's nothing to be proud of, but no reason to be ashamed. This is the fine line on the spiritual path. Mary had the courage, the absolute courage, to disregard everybody and everything and follow that call of Jesus because she knew that was the only thing that mattered. It wasn't just that Jesus was there in the physical body, but she felt that call in her heart. In our reading today, Swamiji says, don't ever sacrifice even a minute of true inner joy to a lesser duty. And don't become confused about what duty we have. We don't have a duty to be comfortable, to be secure, to find ease in our life. Someone said about Ananda once, there was a little controversy going on about something, and somebody remarked, well, you know, we need to make people at Ananda feel safe. And people say things like that. We need to make people feel safe. And that's sort of a phrase that's around. I said, no, we need to make people feel extremely threatened. You know, their egos should be absolutely threatened by being at Ananda. Of course, I didn't mean that really. I didn't mean that we should all go around like this. But heavens, the last thing we want to feel is safe. In the sense of safely sort of settled down in the consciousness we already have. And everybody just pats us on the head and says, isn't that nice? Aren't you wonderful? Once we were somewhere and Swamiji was talking about self-love and self-acceptance. And he said he had been at some program where people were saying, now everyone love yourself and put your arms around and give yourself a hug like this. Swamiji said, tremendous number of things about you are not at all lovable. You know, you don't want to love our weaknesses, our selfishness, our misunderstanding. And then he was talking about self-acceptance. And he said, the only way to self-acceptance is to have a clear conscience. Just such a straight-up statement, isn't it? But that doesn't mean we should be ashamed either. But we just need to look at it like it really is. We will be self-realized masters. When I was writing to my friend and he was writing to me about his passionate relationship with his wife, I said, well, if you didn't have that passion for her, you probably wouldn't even be together. And the overall effect of your relationship is wonderful. And you're going to do wonderful things together. You're going to have a very happy life. So it's not like I'm suggesting to you that you throw this out of your life. It's just part of who you are. It's part of where we're going. But eventually you will transcend it. Because we will transcend everything that ties the soul to the body. Everything that gives us ego. And in the meantime, we just live as we live. And it's not really, it doesn't matter what we're doing that's not ideal. As long as we're doing everything we can that we're capable of doing, that's a sincere expression of our consciousness that is ideal. And that's what Mary says to us. Mary says, here is Jesus with me. Nothing, nothing matters more than that. And for that reason, she is and has lived, this incident has lived for all these centuries as a crystallization of that one-pointed devotion, that one-pointed focus on the only thing that matters, that will take all of us exactly where we want to be, at the feet of the divine, with no other thought but to offer ourselves there with wholehearted determination. God bless you.